Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
It's Wednesday, the 19th of May 2021, and this is Reconstruction. I'm David Taylor, editor of the Construction Index magazine, joined as usual by Phil Bishop, editor of our daily online news at theconstructionindex.co.uk. How are you doing there, Phil?
I'm doing well, David. How are you doing? How are things in sunny Devon?
Well, actually, it is sunny at the moment. I'm doing very well. In fact, I bumped into a neighbour while I was walking the dog this morning who opined that I was living the dream. I don't know what he meant by that, but I suppose I should be grateful. Maybe he knows more than I do. But anyway, things are all right. I think that probably this chap was overexcited by the relaxing of the lockdown conditions. He's probably been to the pub and stayed there since Monday. Anyway.
Well, I think last week I dared mention the phrase post-COVID life.
And yeah.
Within 24 hours of uttering that phrase, it suddenly seemed like I was speaking far too prematurely. We don't quite know where we are just yet, but hey, we can go to the pub. We'll go inside pubs.
Yes, indeed. Although my pub has only just opened. They're opening today. I don't know. They've probably obviously had some alterations to make inside or something like that. But no, it'll be packed, but I'm not going to be there. Anyway, Phil, what have we got going on? You've posted some interesting stories on the news website this week. What do you want to start with?
Well, I'll do a quick run through of our topics for today, which is the economy, project bank accounts,
yeah,
concrete batteries, and let's call it urban planning.
Urban planning sounds...
A report that's out that's interesting, and we'll come on to it at the end and talk about it.
Yeah.
OK. But first up, there's been a lot in the papers about the emergence of inflation. Well, inflation's just emerging. It's been around for ever in one form or shape or another, but it's on the increase. And a little bit of inflation is no bad thing. Too much inflation causes more problems than it fixes. And we've got this week Arcadis, the Dutch firm of consulting engineers, but they're E.C. Harris, as was, is part of Arcadis. And they produce a quarterly, as do their competitors, produce quarterly reviews of what they think is happening to tender prices so that, I guess, contractors and developers can sort of see, right, we need to build this into our, factor this into our the price we can expect to pay next year, the year after, or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And on the back of fairly buoyant economic activity, but more particularly on the back of material shortages that we've been talking about, Arcadis is forecasting a substantial leap in tender price inflation for this year, particularly for infrastructure construction. Infrastructure construction, 3% this year, and then 5% for the 4 years thereafter, which gives a cumulative increase over the next 5 years of 23%. Now, you think of something like HS2 with its price tag of 100 billion, or they say officially it's 72 to 98 billion is the official window at the moment for the full network with all contingencies put in. Now, if they put all contingencies in that figure of 72 to 98 billion, you would have thought there'd be an element of inflation in there. But whether they've got 23% inflation factored in there, or if we're talking about 10 years, we're talking 50 billion quid over the course of 10 years, more than that, added to the price of HS2. I mean, an awful lot of extra money that people are going to have to pay for their construction projects. For building works is not quite so steep, but regional building construction tender price inflation, according to Arcadis, Over the next 5 years, 16%, and in London, slightly less, 14%.
Yeah,
it's quite hefty. It's quite a thing.
Why more in the provinces and less in London? Any clue to that?
I think there's been a relative slowdown in activity in London. There's less capacity constraint, less capacity constraints. Look at the other inflation stats that have come out from the Office of National Statistics this week. Consumer prices index, that's your shopping basket down at Tesco, over the 12 months to April this year, consumer prices index, including owner-occupiers' housing costs, mortgage repayments, I guess, has gone up by 1.6%, which is top end of okay. It was 1% before then. Yeah, 1%, 1.6%, we're talking about shopping baskets. But when it comes to industry, the headline rate of input prices for manufacturing and so on shows 9.9% over the year to April, which is a lot. I mean, it's basically 10% input prices. Particularly in there is petroleum products have gone up 50% in the past year. Now, that sounds terrible, or wonderful if you like inflation, but it sounds pretty hefty. But, of course, April 2020, the price of oil had tanked. So this 10% increase is from a low point. So it's been, you know, a big growth, but you'd expect a big growth from the low point of April 2020 when there was a big lockdown.
Yeah, sure.
What perhaps is slightly more, I mean, producer prices, the output prices and the input prices always vary. I think the input prices are more volatile than the output prices. The output prices, i.e. the prices that the manufacturers of finished goods can expect to get. The output price has gone up by 3.9% over the past year, as opposed to 9.9% for their input prices. So that's going to impact on profitability, it seems to me. I'm not an economist. I ditched economics after a year at university for something much easier, basically. I had it as my minor subject.
Yeah.
It's only later I realised most economics is basic common sense if you can just get past the jargon. But I couldn't get past the jargon when I was at uni. Anyway, some interesting inflation stats which look concerning for manufacturers. And the construction specifiers, estimators and clients need to be aware that this is all going on.
Mm. Are labour costs a factor in all this? I mean, because, of course, we've had this problem of, chronic problem of a labour shortage. So I imagine that labour costs must be going up as well. Is that mentioned anywhere in this report?
Well, there's conflicting data. As far as Arcadis say, they say that it's likely flat. The wage inflation, they say, is certainly currently flat. So they don't put that as particularly significant. However, there was a separate report from Hudson Contract. The I would have to call them payroll people. I never know how pejorative that term is. Hudson Contract look after the payroll services of 30,000 or so construction workers.
Yeah.
So they got a lot of. Are they self-employed or do they work for Hudson Contract? Moot point. But
don't open that one.
But according to the 30,000 people, which is a fairly reasonable representation sample, you would suggest.
Yep.
They say that nationwide. Hang on, what have we got? I've got all the regional differences. Salary's gone up near 20%, nearly a fifth. Since the first lockdown a year ago. Now, again, that could have been from a low spot, but Hudson Contract's latest analysis of payroll data. Do I say data or data? No, I know, I normally say data. Should I be saying data? What are the English?
No, say data. Yeah, everybody says data.
I can never
remember
which is English and which is American. Data shows... data shows average weekly earnings of £878 during April, an increase of 19.6% on the year before. Big regional variations, 29% down your neck of the woods in the southwest to less than 5% in London.
Hmm. Well, I'm not getting any of that.
you remember, was it last month, we had the fabulous Rudy Klein on the yes. podcast, the former chief executive of the Special Engineering Contractors group. And we were talking about project bank accounts, amongst many other things. And he revealed how the major tier one contractors had tried to keep reference of project bank accounts out of the construction playbook. Construction playbook we've also talked about, published last December by the Cabinet Office, which sets out the government best practice for public sector procurement. And it's not entirely, in fact, it's not omitted from the playbook, despite the major contractors' best efforts. It's in there. Government,
but it's only got a one mention or something like that.
But it's a clear
like
mention. It says, use project bank accounts unless there are good reasons not to. But where there are other things that have got case studies and how-tos and guides on, you know, and bigging it up, there are no case studies of how great project bank accounts are. It's not accompanied in the playbook, as other policies are, by...
It's played down, I think.
Yeah. It is underplayed.
Well, that's what Rudy was saying.
It's sort of, you know, page 32 or somewhere towards the back, just sort of mentioned. Yeah, but it could have been made a headline topic, and it wasn't. But it's in there anyway. There is a Labour MP called Debbie Abraham who is familiar with this topic. Mm-hmm. She actually introduced a private members bill after the Carillion collapse, which Rudy Klein was involved with. I think he helped draft it. She wanted to introduce, by law, that project bank accounts would have to be used on any public sector construction contract with a value of more than £500,000.
Hmm.
Now, subsequently, the received wisdom is that £500,000 is a bit low to need a project bank account. But for higher value contracts, there is broad consensus, notwithstanding the few big contractors who don't like being told what they can and can't do with other people's money. There's full consensus that project bank accounts are good things. Hence, it's in the playbook.
Yeah.
Anyway, Debbie Abrahams has been asking questions of various government departments, and we've had the answers back from the relevant ministers to the questions that she's been asking. She's basically asked all these government departments, how much are they using project bank accounts? And, you know, what are they using it for and how's it going, kind of thing. She actually says, what information is held on the use of project bank accounts by your department and its agencies and the non-departmental bodies for which the department is responsible? And she asked that of Ministry of Housing, she asked of the Department of Transport, Department of Education, three departments with big building programmes, and the Cabinet Office, which is in charge of procurement and the daddy of the playbook. And the answers she got back were quite, I think, illuminating. Maybe we should do a quick recap on what project bank accounts are for any first-time listeners.
Yeah, good idea.
Essentially, it's a ring-fenced account. It's money held in escrow from which, if you, David, are the main contractor and I'm a subcontractor, and when the government pays you to do a job, the money that is going to you, which should then flow through to all your suppliers, instead of going straight to you and you sit on it and wait sometime later when you want to pay me, it goes into escrow, into an independently held pot, and when everything's agreed, we all take our money out, and it's held there in safety, so that if you go bust or if you're a crook, I'm still guaranteed my money as a supplier, which a lot of Carillion suppliers didn't get their money, which is why Debbie Abraham's picked up on the issue. So, project bank accounts, broadly considered, a good thing. So this is what the various government ministers had to say. The minister from Ministry of Housing, Communities and Local Government, we don't hold data on project bank accounts. If we've assessed it is not practical, efficient and cost-effective to use them on our construction projects... It doesn't say because we haven't, it says if we have assessed it's not practical, efficient and cost-effective, we don't hold data.
No.
Along with all government departments and a set out in the construction playbook, we have committed to use PBAs on our construction projects unless there are compelling reasons not to. In other words, it's repeating the party line. We're going to use them unless we decide not to use them, but we don't hold any data that we can share with you. In other words, no idea. Transport Minister says, a little bit more information here. Project bank accounts are used to ensure fair payment terms on government construction contracts. Right. As these are specific to construction projects, they're not used by the Department for Transport nor its agencies. Interesting choice of words. Highways England now is no longer an agency, technically. It's an arm's length body. But it says, however, the department's non-departmental bodies do engage in construction works and do use them to improve cash flow, mitigate risk of payment delay, and to reduce the risk of supply chain failure. In other words, Highways England is using project bank accounts, probably Network Rail as well, concluding this. And he says, the use of these provide transparency and insurance over payments to suppliers, lower down the supply chain in particular. Now, that doesn't answer the question. The question was, what data do you have? Well, we know that they're being used. We know that. And we know that they're good.
We don't know to what extent.
We don't know to what extent projects. Or how much or what money's being held in project bank accounts. So the Department of Transport don't know and the Department of Housing don't know. Okay, then we go to the Department of Education. And there the schools minister answers. And to be fair, I'm going to give him the pass on this one. Because the Department of Education says, we've considered the use of project bank accounts for school construction projects. But due to the specific nature, size and volume of our school construction projects, we've assessed that it's not practical, efficient and cost effective to use them. Therefore, there are compelling reasons not to deploy project bank accounts on Department for Education projects. Accordingly, we don't have any information on them, which is fair enough. They're not using them, and they say there are good reasons, because most of these schools projects, I think there are some schools projects which are more like 30 million odd, which probably are in the threshold of could use them.
Yeah,
but a lot of them are sort of, you know, 2, 4, 6, 8 million pound projects. And
what's the threshold again?
You know, I can't remember. Rudy did tell us. We'll have to listen back to that. I've got a figure of 10 or 20 million in my head, but I may be completely out on that, so don't quote me. Okay. Cabinet Office, which is the sponsoring department of the Construction Playbook and Public Sector Procurement. Very interesting answer. This department, says the Parliamentary Secretary at the Cabinet Office, this department does not hold specific information on the use of project bank accounts. However, as the PBA policy lead, we do engage with departments and their arm's length bodies about their PBA usage, including indicative spend.
Oh, so they're going to spill the beans.
When the use of PBSAs was being established, we did collect data on the value of government contracts making use of them. During that period, which was 2011 to 2015, more than £10 billion was spent on a wide range of construction projects using PBAs. So finally, from the Cabinet Office, we have a firm statistic, which Debbie Abrahams was asking for. Unfortunately, it's statistics from 2011 to 2015 from the coalition government, two governments ago. Not interesting, not useful. Now, if the Cabinet Office is collecting, engaging with departments on indicative spend on project bank accounts, you would have thought that they and the relevant departments would have that information.
Yeah.
So why they're not sharing it with Debbie Abrahams, I can only conclude that they don't know. Because it's not like saying how much money is in the pot of that particular contract, which might be commercial in confidence. There might be contractual reasons why they shouldn't be saying who's getting what money at this stage, whatever. But the overall spend on, for example, what Highways England has got in project bank accounts currently, that there can be no commercial conflict in revealing that, it seems to me. So I don't know why the secrecy. And I suspect it's not secrecy. I suspect, as ever, it's incompetence, because that's normally the reason for these things.
It just seems to me that there's a sort of distinct lack of enthusiasm for the whole concept of project bank accounts in the government. I mean, the fact that Rudy seems to think that Tier 1 contractors are a guinea generally and try to keep it out of the playbook. I don't know whether or not somebody's being lent on here or whether major contractors are saying to government departments and potential clients that these really aren't a good idea, chaps, but, you know, we've got to keep it in because it looks good. Surely, I think there's just a lack of commitment to the idea.
Well, there's also this, the way it's balanced. We're definitely going to use them, except when there are compelling reasons not to.
Well, you can always find a compelling reason if you want to. I mean,
can't be asked.
That's not a problem.
I'm compelled.
Yeah,
compelled not.
It's a way out. That's a bit depressing, really. I think that most people, if you spelled out the concept of project bank accounts, would say it's a bit like motherhood and apple pie. You can't really criticize it. There's nothing wrong to say. There's nothing bad to say about it, unless of course it doesn't actually work to your advantage, and that is the case with tier one contractors. They like to have the money in the bank. They like to earn the interest. They like that that buffer, if you like.
I can imagine it adds an element of extra cost and bureaucracy. So that could be a reason against it, particularly if you're talking about a £3.50 bill. just get on and pay it.
Yeah, I don't think that's a good enough reason, though. I mean, we know the damage that payment abuse does to the supply chain. Companies go under, and if big companies go under, they often take smaller ones with them because they are financially dependent upon the on their client. There's a clear benefit to the use of project bank accounts. I think that's the thing that is for the general good, and you can't really argue against that. It's just that the people who are at the top of the tree, it makes life slightly more complicated for them and less secure, I suppose.
Well, it gives them less cash flow to play with.
Yeah, well, exactly, yeah.
And paying on time gives them less cash flow.
Yeah.
Although, fair play, most
of them do. The worrying thing, though, is if...
Sorry, go on.
Sorry, I was going to say that the worrying thing is if... The government's apparent lack of enthusiasm for the idea is down to the fact that they're being lent on by major contractors. I mean, I don't know what sort of influence a major contractor can exert on a public sector client. It usually works the other way around, but I don't understand why the government isn't more behind the idea. It seems a puzzle to me.
Well... we'll see. We'll see what happens. I've actually emailed Debbie Abrams this morning to say, okay, now you've got this information or lack of information. What are you going to do with it? What now? Where are we going with this? So it'd be interesting to see what I hear back from her.
Yes. Watch this space then. Right. Phil, we've got a technical story.
Well, yeah, having started off a little out of my depth talking about inflation, I felt a bit more comfortable talking about project bank accounts. The next two topics, I'm going to start feeling increasingly out of my depth. I'm going to let you take the lead on these. Tell us about this Swedish research that we've our colleague Lisa Russell has written about on Construction Index.
Yeah. It's a very interesting story. In fact, it's the more you think about it, the more fascinating it is. I mean, the press release came in from
Chalmers University of Technology in
Chalmers
Sweden.
Chalmers University of Technology, which is a Swedish university, which I never heard of, I have to admit. They've been doing some interesting research. I can't remember which department it is. They've got a...
architecture and engineering. Get with the program.
Architecture and engineering. Yeah. But the researchers, they sound like a fantastic duo, Luping Lang and Emma Zhang. They've been looking into the potential. Well, it's about energy storage, which, of course, is a really important topic. Buildings, we all know, are huge consumers of energy and emitters of carbon, all the rest of it. And storing electrical power is extremely difficult. Basically, only two real technologies. There's pumped storage, which is basically hydroelectricity. You cheap electricity to pump water up into a reservoir, and then at peak times you send it down through turbines to generate electricity, more expensive electricity, which is obviously not really a massive solution to the problem of storing electricity. The other one, of course, is batteries, and there has been a lot of technological developments in the use of batteries. You can get bigger batteries which store more energy now, but it's still very, very expensive. And again, it's not a huge solution. It's certainly not a cure-all. Well, anyway, they've come up with an idea which I think has a lot of potential. I've often thought about solar power, for example. Solar power is a great thing, and I've never understood why, especially, you know, when I drive around the area I live in the West Country, you see acres and acres of prime pasture land covered with solar panels, which doesn't look particularly pretty. And I know that they say, oh, you know, the sheep can graze underneath the panels, all the rest of it, but it's not really nice. And I don't think that agricultural land should be used for that. I've always thought you should, any municipal, industrial, or I don't know, large scale building should by law be required to have be absolutely bristling with solar panels. They've got big roofs, they've got large facades. Use all that to generate solar power.
Well, that's happening increasingly. These network rail bridges are now
getting. It is happening.
Is it Blackfriars Bridge, which is the one out of the station? Hungerford Bridge, I think. They've got a new basically solar panel roof all the way atop of it.
Oh, that's right. Yes, yes. Oh, yeah, that is Blackfriars. Yes, you're right. These researchers at the Swedish University are actually looking into the possibility of creating rechargeable concrete batteries. People have looked at this before, apparently, but the trouble is, I think it's energy density is the phrase that people use. You can't really store an awful lot of energy in these concrete batteries. But Dr. Zhang and her colleague, Professor Tang, have developed a technology, or are developing a technology, that has a much better energy density.
Well, it's only a concept, I think, isn't it? They haven't actually they haven't developed technology so much, but they reckon they've cracked the secret for making a huge, great building-sized concrete battery.
Yeah, I think it's a great idea. I mean,
how are they doing it?
Well, they're not explicit about the technology, but they say, and I'll read the bit from the press release. It said the concept involves first a cement-based mixture with small amounts of short carbon fibres added to increase the conductivity and flexural toughness. Then embedded within the mixture is a metal-coated carbon fibre mesh, iron for the anode and nickel for the cathode. After much experimentation, this is the prototype which the researchers now present. So I don't know quite how that works. I mean, there's obviously far more to it than that short paragraph reveals. But the idea that you could pump electricity into your walls or into your concrete frame or into your foundations, your piles even, you know, and actually store energy in that way, I think, I mean, if they can do it, it has huge potential. It really would improve the energy profile of a building if it could both generate electricity and store it as well. So I'm quite interested in this, and I will certainly be watching it to see if anything comes of it. They talk about energy density, and they say that cement-based batteries they have actually produced a rechargeable cement-based battery with an average density of 7 watt-hours per square metre, or 0.8 watt-hours per litre. They don't, unfortunately, give a comparison to other technologies' energy density, so you can't really gauge how efficient it is. But apparently, it is a lot better than anything else that's been achieved so far with concrete batteries or cement. Yeah, but exactly.
They're saying it could be more than 10 times more efficient than early attempts at concrete batteries. Mm. But 10 times diddly squat is still diddly squat, isn't
it? Well, that's it. Yeah, I mean, I don't know how much. Obviously, if you compare it to something like a lithium-ion battery, that must have a massive energy density because, you know, obviously the battery on your phone is tiny and it does an awful lot of work. So clearly,
they're saying the energy density is still low in comparison to commercial batteries, but we can get around this by making our concrete batteries blooming huge, building size.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Well, that's it. That's the thing. I mean, the wonderful thing is it is really easy to scale it up if you're talking about buildings, because, I mean, there's, by definition, you've got to scale it up. It's going to be big. So, you know, this has been one of the, with battery technology over the recent, you know, over recent years, the things which have made mobile phones and, you know, sort of portable devices portable and made electric vehicles commercially viable is the fact that energy densities have been increased massively and battery size has been reduced. This looks at it from the other end of the telescope, that you've got a lower energy density, but you've got a massive capacity in a building. So that's pretty clever, I think. And if they could do it, I think it'd be brilliant.
There's a slight Bond villain aspect to this, which I enjoy. Whether it's Christopher Walken or Jonathan Pryce or one of those sort of Bond villains who have this lair which has got some secret function, and his secret function is it's a battery, it's not a building.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I think, I don't know how it would work. I mean, I don't know how you would avoid electrocuting yourself if you touched two elements.
It would be a building and a battery, wouldn't it? It would be a building that doubles.
Yes, it would.
Yes.
But if you were, for example, if you were sort of hanging a shelf and you drilled into the wrong bit of the building, would you electrocute yourself? I mean, at the moment, all the electricity in a building is safely guided through very small wires and cables, and you can easily avoid them. I mean, if your entire concrete frame is charged with several thousand volts and a dozen amps or something, then you get that.
Well, we used to check the power in batteries drill by licking the top of them. So presumably you just check.
Right, how would you do that with a building?
Climb on the roof.
Go and lick a soffit. Go and lick a soffit or something like that. Yeah, I don't know how it would work. I don't know whether or not you'd have to encase the entire building in rubber or something in order to insulate it. I suppose those are obviously not. That'd be quite interesting, a rubber-coated building. But anyway, I think, they'll get around that. That's just a mere detail. They've got to get the batteries to work first. But, great story, I think.
But poor concrete takes such a clobbering, and cement, they take such a clobbering, don't they, from the environmental lobby.
Yes.
That it's good for that material, yeah, as a concept to justify itself.
Oh, it is. I mean, not a day goes by that you don't hear something about zero carbon or low carbon concrete. It's really the main topic of conversation in cement and concrete sectors at the moment, I think, is how to actually reduce concrete's or cement's huge carbon footprint, because it's very, I think it's supposed to be the second largest emitter of CO2. I don't know. I don't know what's first. I can never remember that. But cement has an issue at the moment. So anything that can mitigate its environmental harm, I suppose, is a good thing. But this is great. I love this.
Right.
So are we done with rechargeable walls, rechargeable frames, rechargeable this, that, and the other?
Concrete batteries. Yeah.
Funnily enough, the French word for battery is peel, isn't it? Pile. So, maybe we'll be calling them piles as well. Right. So shall we move on to our...
Our final topic.
You've
been reading a report published by Arup and the University of Westminster, which hadn't read.
I have
until
indeed.
You drew my attention to it yesterday, and I've not covered this on in our news coverage on the Construction Index. Maybe I should have done.
Okay.
But if people want to read more about this later on, you have to look on Arup's website, or maybe the University of Westminster's website.
Yes.
Go on, tell us about this report you've been reading.
Well, it's more about planning and design, really, than anything else. It is a can of worms, and it is a topic that, in fact, I think a lot of people, even some of the people quoted in the report, will admit a lot of people steer clear of. They don't want to broach the topic for fear of being no-platformed or in some other way attacked. Well, we're going to broach the topic because, after all, we were sent the press release by, as you say, the University of Westminster and Arup. So I'll read the opening paragraph again in their own words.
What's it called? What's it called, this report?
I'm coming on to that.
Okay.
The University of Westminster and Arup, the global engineering and design firm, have today published a new report exploring... This is today, by the way, was Monday, Monday of this week. Have today published a new report exploring the relationship between queer communities and public spaces. Queering Public Space, that's the title of the report, calls for an urgent rethink in how towns and cities are designed and provides recommendations for how they can be made more inclusive for all. And it goes into a lot of detail. I say it goes into a lot of detail. There are quite a lot of words. As reports go, it's quite brief. But there's a lot of talk in there about the way public spaces are designed and have been designed for, you know, the whole of history, really.
By men, for men.
In a way
men.
That is not... By men, for men, and in a way that is not welcoming to... well, they use the term queer, the queer community, which itself is an all-encompassing phrase. There's a lot of talk about things like monotonous streetscapes of regimented buildings in designated commercial areas that are perceived as positively anti-queer spaces.
What they're trying to address, I think, in my reading of the report, is that they're saying that there are places in Soho, Manchester Canal Street, place in Brighton, where LGBTQ plus people feel safe and happy, and it's an environment where they feel comfortable, and they don't feel that comfortable in many other places, and that's not right. They should feel as comfortable everywhere, frankly. Because when I read the press release that you got, my first reaction was, what, we need to redesign places, become less heteronormal and here we go.
Yes.
Public space needs to be queered if LGBTQ plus people are to find these spaces accessible, safer and more inclusive.
Yeah.
And before I read it, I thought, hang on a minute. And then I read it, I thought, no, they've got a point. Of course, everyone should feel safe, or at least should not be feel excluded specifically by the design of a place.
No, indeed. But one of the funny things is I felt that reading through the report, it was pretty vague. I mean, they did start to break down some of the elements that they think should be addressed. But an awful lot of the talk, and there are accompanying videos and interviews and things like this where people are talking about this, in very what I felt were very vague terms. And I just felt, well, why they talk about designing in diversity, which again, I think is just too vague a phrase. One of the co-authors of the report, or certainly somebody who's been leading the project, is a professor of history at Westminster. I think it's history at Westminster University. Professor Pippa Catterall says, designing in diversity can also help to usualise marginalised and disempowered groups like LGBTQ plus people, promoting their inclusion in public space. Ways to do this include attention to the scale and mass of buildings, roof lines, colours and facades, curvilinear aspects, varied sight lines, breakup of space, softening of soundscapes and visual environments through choice of surfaces, greenery and water features, etc, etc, etc. And I just think, well, yeah, what's not to like about that? I'd prefer environments like that. What I found myself repeatedly asking myself was, why is this specific to the queer community when it applies equally to other people, including other minorities, racial minorities, the disabled, and people like you and me as well? You know, people who are not considered to be a member of a minority. I just think... You can't argue with it.
I do agree with you. I think it's not intended, this report is not intended to say this is how to design streets. It's meant to start a conversation, and it's worked. We're talking about it. And for that, it's a good thing. But like you say, it talks about queering, examples of spaces regarded as queer inclusive, I'm quoting here, were ones that had a diverse feel to them. They're not uniform in terms of scale and massive buildings, roof lines, colour or facades. They were not rectilinear, and they offered a range of sight lines through spaces which were punctuated by features. Their soundscapes are softened by greenery or bodies of water rather than harshened by hard surfaces. Space was not open and intimidating, but broken up and intimate. Now, there are two aspects. One is, what does one feel... anyone feel a desirable, attractive place to live or spend time or work or holiday or whatever. And that can be different things for different people. I've got a friend who's chosen to live in the Barbican. God knows why. I would hate to, but it's heaven on earth for him. And the other thing is the question of, which a lot of what this report about is where people feel physically safe. Now,
yes,
LGBTQ plus people are more liable to feeling, I think, physically insecure than you and I because of They talk about male-dominated spaces in which homophobes who tend to act in packs can easily intimidate.
Yes. Now,
I don't like places where people acting in packs can easily intimidate. But I don't think that is unique to either myself or LGBTQ plus people. I think women who I think make up a marginally a majority of the country, maybe underrepresented in many ways, but in terms of numbers, they're not a minority. I think women feel, by and large, that intimidated in certain places.
Yeah.
So this is not about designing, or I think it's less about designing, streetscapes, towns, urban areas for any particular sexual orientation or type. It's more about for anyone who doesn't want to get beaten up.
Well, that's true. I mean, there are references within the report to other things which do hint at specific things, which I think, I don't know whether or not this is just an argument too far, but even things like the classic suburban domestic environment where, you know, streets or roads or avenues or closes are arranged with family homes in them, because the nuclear family is a heteronormative concept of father and mother and 2.5 children, and this itself is exclusionary for queer people, which I think a lot of LGBTQ plus people might argue with. I found that a bit of an argument I certainly couldn't agree with.
You cannot necessarily create that sense of belonging. It comes from heritage and history, and that you know, Canal Street was not built as a gay area. It became that, and Bloomsbury was not built as a gay area. It became that, or at least became inviting or sympathetic or not alien. But I think it would have carried more weight if gender identity had just been one part of it. If the authors had widened it out and talked about the general sense of different types of people. And I hate the idea of community. I'm not a member of the white male heterosexual middle-aged community. I just am a white male middle-aged man. Decreasingly middle aged, unfortunately. But anyway, but we've talked before the idea of BAME as a all encompassing term is moving out of fashion. And I think the idea of grouping people together and saying you have a common fight or battle here, therefore we're going to put you all in the same basket and same argument. I'm uncomfortable with. I think different people have different issues depending on their own personal circumstances. And I think, if this report had instead talked about the LGBTQ plus community and creating queer public spaces, simply how can we better design public spaces so that people who feel vulnerable for whatever reason can feel less vulnerable?
Yeah.
And I think that becomes, in many ways, more interesting. And you then get into the whole issue, which we haven't actually talked about it on our podcast, but it's something that I've certainly written about over the years, of designing out crime, for example. I mean, this is a big part of the after Broadwater Farm in Tottenham became a no-go area for police in the 80s, and PC Keith Blakelock was killed. There became a big drive, a big think amongst urban planners of avoiding creating dark alleys and blind corners and creating sight lines. And similarly, from this new prisons, Belmarsh, for example, was the first in a new generation in prisons where there are no corners for people to hide behind. Everything's all sort of rounded and safety designed in. And then following on from that, they started designing schools to avoid corners where, you know, little
school bully could
exactly
hide.
Exactly that, or you know, sticking younger pupils' heads down toilets or whatever.
Designing out the scope for bullying from schools and scope for bad behaviour, yeah. and you know, removing smoking areas or whatever, you know, having nothing behind the bike shed. And so the whole idea of designing places to be A, welcoming, but B, to prevent aspects of behaviour that yeah. you want to eliminate, discourage, whatever, is a fascinating yeah. one. And this report goes to that.
Yeah, it does. I think that one of the problems I have with it is that there's a clear undercurrent of identity politics beneath it. As you say, it is focusing on the queer community. Not to the exclusion, because they do admit that it right at the end of the report, it actually says, you know, all the foregoing could apply equally to other minority groups.
And it goes further than that, it says addressing these design features would benefit all sections of the community rather than simply LGBTQ yeah. plus people. So they're not even saying this is for all minorities or all people yeah. who sometimes feel vulnerable for whatever reasons.
It's just better urban design.
It's better for everyone. And I kind of agree with yeah. that. I don't want to live in the
Balkans. Yeah, me too. In a way, one of the things which I found myself reflecting on, which is strange that Arup has partnered with the University of Westminster on this, because there's no mention anywhere of the architectural obsession with tall, thrusting skyscrapers, which are probably the ultimate expression.
No, it's not Westminster, though. No, Westminster's against tall buildings. That's all in the city, the City of London Corporation.
Oh, I know. Well, yeah, but what I'm saying is that they don't mention, you know, surely, I've always thought it's rather strange, you know, stupid, in fact, of states and cities to say, we've got the tallest building, you know, and we've just put a flagpole on top of this one and it's taller than yours, because it's purely phallic. It's all about male power and all the rest of it. And Arup prides itself on being one of the world's foremost designers of tall buildings, the Gherkin, the Shard, the Pinnacle. Arup says, you know, you want a tall building? Come to us. You know, we're good at this sort of thing. We can engineer it for you. And I've always thought.
Did Arup do the Shard? I didn't think they did the Shard, did they?
They did some. I can't remember who the consulting engineer was on the Shard, but it wasn't Arup. Arup did have a role on the Shard, and I can't remember what it was.
Had a role. I thought WSP. It might have been
WSP, but I said. I mean, the Burj Al Alam in Dubai was one of Arup's, I think, and that's, you know. These tall buildings, I've never liked. I don't like going in them, and I don't really like, well, the way the London skyline is developing.
Are they macho? It seems to me some of them are incredibly camp. They're just bling.
Well, I suppose, yes, you could see that.
I think we've covered some ground there. We've covered inflation, procurement, energy, sexual politics and urban planning.
That's not bad for one morning.
Well, thank you for listening, everyone. That's all we're going to do for this week. And we will be back again, David and I, at the same time next week. Let's be hearing from you. podcast@theconstructionindex.co.uk. As I say, most of what we've been talking about is reported at theconstructionindex.co.uk, except for Queering Public Spaces is a report by Arup and the University of Westminster on, I would imagine, both of their respective websites.
Yeah.
But for now, thank you and goodbye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.